So the Zen XEN virtualization systems, they are mostly working on Linux. And there's some PSD in there, and some Windows in there. And the key progress they are making from what I can see, and I'm not directly involved, is that they're starting to support new CPU features. So these are for vendor pool and for AMD's hosting, but the different stuff to exploit the new CPU features that make this kind of virtualization cheaper to implement with a lower overhead. Traditionally, if you were in something like VMware, there's like a 15-20% overhead of just running your client systems. And with Zen, well, first of course, your operating system is aware that it runs in a virtualized environment. It plays nice with the hypervisor. Second, with the new CPU restrictions coming out, overall cost of running virtualization can go down to only a few percent, which is very, very attractive. The I/O scheduling is, I think, the weakest point of any units I see. And not me myself, but some people in my technical line of command have spoken to Linux developers, not Linux and Andrew Morton and David Miller about this, and I don't think they really recognize the problem. Because most of these folks run script for their desktops, and they don't really understand running a mixed-heavy server workload. And I think IBM understands the problem fairly well, but I haven't seen many results for this yet. Now, something similar goes on for scheduling, which is a very hard problem. And the remark one of my colleagues made is that no problem when it's ever gets solved if a single person cannot make proven progress in 1 week. Because beyond that, they just throw it away. There is no systematic design. And the example he used for scheduling is like, suppose you have a many CPU system, and it is a non-uniform memory architecture system. In such an environment, scheduling long-running tasks is quite hard. And secrets, you know, part of IBM, has equaled several very good math people on this problem, and they went through several iterations. After 2 or 3 years, they produced something that really worked, and was probably within like 5 or 10% of like, the optimal solution that you could compute like in finite time in the operating system. And what you see on Linux is just the reverse. What they do instead is programmable schedulers. You know, there's like 5,000 schedulers out there, and you plug in the one that fits your workload. And that's exactly what I don't want. I want somebody to see systematically study the problem. And historically, that's what the PhD has done. They have studied the problem and come up with something that is more work that actually influence the right model. Have I seen that same system done for I/O bandwidth? No, I haven't seen that. It was a key missing feature. Have I looked at the work that Kramer's done? I haven't studied it, but from what I understand, please correct me if I'm wrong, the Dragonfly Pulsar is focusing on better multi-thread performance and lower latency. They don't seem to be focusing on running multiple I/O limited workloads on the same hardware at the same time and being able to give some sort of a fair allocation between. It's just a very different class of products. I don't think that any of the open Unixes, any of them, Linux, BSD, whatever, are seriously focusing on this.
Just a quick comment that I have. I think that the emphasis on Dragonfly is a clustered environment that could contribute to the network service. So you actually have a clustered bunch of CPUs, and each function has a single accessibility.
Okay, that's a good point. So apparently Dragonfly is focusing more on clusters, and okay, that's not something that we necessarily do. One thing that maybe didn't really explain, if you compare Fireworks to Google, if Google has a large number of machines, and they can get by with a very different operating model, let's say in a very, very small number of applications. If any typical machine then has one application, say Google Mail, Google Search, or something like that, and they have maybe 10 of these applications out there. We have thousands of applications that run completely unpredictable combinations on the hosts. So that tends to stress out machine very, very differently.
What I'm suggesting is you can have 20 servers functioning as a single AFS server.
You can have 20 servers functioning as a single AFS server. And I was sort of trying to make a point that that's not our problem.
Okay.
We know how to run AFS servers. Where things tend to go wrong is if I have, say, a foreign exchange trading machine that runs separate applications at the same time for five different markets, and then all are written in different databases that run different versions of the network protocol, and then have different market close hours and different memory pressures at the time. So when you, in general, when you're running a mixture of very different applications on the same machine at the same time, then when you start running into trouble, whether it's memory pressure or I/O pressure, etc., that's a very different problem from trying to make a single application scale by running on many machines in parallel at the same time. So I think that answers the question.
I had a real question. I just commented that last time. On the way over here, I was thinking about how to deal with the problem that Packet Source has been working on and some other people have been working on as far as the best way to upgrade the packages while systems are running.
So, a good question. How do you best upgrade a package while systems are running? And I think the answer there is you don't. What you do is you install a new version, side by side with the old version. You allow people who depend on it to switch over to the new version over time. And only in those cases where there's actually a security issue involved, do you upgrade by spinning a signal from the old version to the new version, which that means that you can undo the upgrade by spinning the signal back. And all the work that something like Debian is doing to allow you to upgrade your system without ever rebooting is from our group just a waste of time. Because especially if we're going to change our C library and our C++ library in the system, we want to reboot because there's always going to be hidden incompatibilities. That's a fair question. So in terms of I/O management, having seriously incorporated these, the folks and the answer is no, because at this point by many people didn't see a significant event in garbage inscription from Linux to BSD. We all know that if we were to take the 10 million bits of BSD folks and gave them 2 years, what they would do with would be incredibly much better than what we have now in Linux. We're not going to do it. Because we're cheap bastards, okay? We're just going to continue paying our minimum amount of money to have a stream of them for not fixing it. Yeah, and then I'm going to go here in my spare time and say, it would be really nice if this were sold by the FDA. Yes, George.
One of my questions is that the main commercial support venue dealing with Linux is Red Hat. Mm-hmm. Right? So you give them X amount of year for support or what acts like support or whatever else. If Red Hat, and I'm not asking, I hope this doesn't happen because I think we'd all be worse off, but if Red Hat imploded or defloated or anything happened along the way, how would that impact your relation with Linux?
Well, fair question. Suppose that our main Linux vendor were to implode. Okay, Red Hat were to go bankrupt, or even worse, Oracle would buy them. Or something like that. If something like that were to happen, we would have to reevaluate our relationship with the vendor. And then, you know, we historically at WordWork had a very poor look. Like, for example, every help desk system we purchased, the vendor went bankrupt before we actually installed the help desk system. We're still running the software. And in terms of our Solaris environment, we run a desktop environment called TED from a vendor that went out of business like in 95 or 96, and we're still running it, and you know, we quite buy new practice to it ourselves. So we are actually very, very good at keeping something running. So without the vendor. So if it's supposed that Red Hat were to implode, I think the first thing that we would do is try and talk to some of their competitors to see if they could continue to effectively support the same system. So talk to them about
support Red Hat?
So suppose that Red Hat were to go first, which I don't think they will, but we could go to Novell and say, how much will it cost for you to, if we deploy Novell for any future releases, how much would we have to pay to support our legacy systems with a certain backup over time? And at the same time, we would of course reevaluate how much it would cost to switch to something completely new. Yeah, so the short of, say, Oracle buying Red Hat, I don't think we would seriously look at the end now. Question.
I asked a similar question when a couple of meetings ago, and Bill was here. At what point have we gotten full circle when it's another commercial unit?
It's a very fair question. At which point have we gone full circle into commercial units? From my viewpoint, and this is certainly not the official company do them. Red Hat is an evil corporation, and they're very dramatic on the open source movement. So, does my management care? You know, I said, no. Because, frankly, you're an investment bank. You set the tone in terms of evil corporations. It's a fair question. Suppose that Weaver makes a decision like we're going to go for FreeBSD and how do we get vendors to move? And the answer is it's very, very painful. Even the vendors that we have a very, very good relationship with, that we pay millions of dollars per year, it is always very, very hard to get support for new platforms, including open system releases. A key example would be Verisign. Jenny would like to move to new hardware within several months of being available and supported by the OS, and Veritas Jenny takes 6 to 9 months longer to deliver that. And that's under pressure that our managing director of IT calls them on a daily basis and say, when do I get this? Would it systematically help? Not necessarily, because many of these companies are distracted by other things, and for them, the Unix market is maybe a side attraction. Some of these companies are being nursed with a virus detection company. You know, they care far more about having a Unix server version of their Windows virus detection server that can run into Unix file server and Unix mail servers and actually deliver a stable file system. That's just the way the priorities work. And in terms of IBM is an again, I used to include an LZP program. IBM is in a very, very responsive. When we find bugs there, actually feel like it, that we find them because we find them 6 to 12 months before other people find them. They said they can sort of head over the disaster very, very good. And when we ask for specific features, they try and plan that. If they are on the 24-month release cycle, okay? So the next major release, which is going to come out end of next year, probably pretty much going to the point that their translation folks are now translating the manual into 31 languages. They're still debugging the code, but at least they know the basic features are there. They may drop some of the features at the last moment, and the translation people are dealing with that. So even if the vendor is superbly responsive, it doesn't mean they can move quickly. And that's one of the reasons why we love open source software so much. I mean, one thing I told you didn't touch on is that we run as much open source software as we can for as many critical infrastructure components as we can, because it gives us the flexibility to make changes and to move quickly. When a new version came, it comes out with Jenny deployed in 2 or 3 weeks. That's just fast for us. And the whole repo, the real holding system, really 3 to 4 months. And if only more and more vendors were to move to open source, we'd love that. And so I work in Databricks. We have Sybase, we have Oracle, we have Informix, we have DB2. But don't think we're not seriously looking at Postgres and MySQL. And what we expect to happen over time is that we'll start deploying something like MySQL to the low end, people that have 10,000 records and 3 tables. Don't forget though, we have a global team of DBAs with some outsource operations people, and every new product that we install side by side something else adds a significant amount of retraining and operational overhead. So we'll probably install something like MySQL or Postgres by the time it's good enough to replace one of our vendor products, so you could get rid of the vendor products. Question?
Yeah,
see, I said contradicting things. We like, so at one point I said we like the idea of a 2 to 3 month, so 2 to 3 year cycle for operating systems, and then I say we like to move very quickly. The key thing is, one is in terms of support for the core operating system thing, and one is in terms of application level stuff. And
my question is actually, is it just the matter of support? If you could find VSD, if there was a commercial company that would offer support for, you know, VSDs, you know, for 5 years back or 10 years back, would that be a significant difference?
So the question is if suppose that we were to have support from the VSDs, to go back, say, 4 or 5 or 10 years. Now, I think and something I probably didn't emphasize at all, the reason we like to move slowly for the open system is that there's a very real cost to maintaining all these images in parallel. So you want to minimize the number of open system releases you run in parallel, and that's where saying having one major release every 2 or 3 years makes commercial sense. Because we can train our open system folks to support, say, 3 versions of Linux and 3 versions of Solaris. And also, given the way that AFS works, where you have effectively recompiled applications for each platform we support, what that means is that when I push out the new DBT client release, I have to push it out for 2 versions of Linux, basically 2.4 and 2.6 kernel, and 32 of Linux, AMD64, Itanium, Solaris 9, and actually another version for Solaris 8. And that's just one commercial client. When I compile something like those scripts, I have to compile it for like 8 or 9 different flat hardware and OS combinations. So from that viewpoint, we don't want to be in the business of too frequent open system upgrades, because the sheer cost of maintaining that in parallel is very, very hard. What we would like, and that's where the contradictory portion comes in, right? What we would like is for somebody like Red Hat to say, well, you're running Red Hat too, but we're still supplying you the latest and greatest drivers for the latest and greatest hardware that cannot get here. And that is very hard for a company to do if they are on a stable cycle and a new major release every 6 months. Because then the cost of backporting the drivers to each and every of the previous releases over the past 5 years becomes incredibly low. Now, I think that answers some of your question, but I also have to say, yes, we're hypocrites and inconsistent.
I just want to go back to the issue, the drivers and open sourcing and so on. I mean, the fundamental argument isn't like, Intel give up what you perceive as being IP, even though it's just smoke and mirrors. It's a question of documentation and standards. You know, if you're going to change a chipset for the same hardware every 2 to 3 month period, you make it an absolute nightmare. I think that's a different request that you're asking of the large finance firms in New York, technology companies in San Francisco. It's not turning around and saying, you know, ignore all your patents and IP issues. It's that this is what we're running. And frankly, people like you, are in a position to actually, turn around and say, look, nobody's asking for IP, issues. We don't want any NDAs. We just want documentation.
Well, it's not just that we want documentation. If we order 100 desktops from Dell, it would be nice if we order them all the same that they deliver us all the same. That is for, getting 100 desktops in one shipment.
Yeah.
Their documents being the same, and they have the same model number and the same graphics card number, and there are 3 different chips in there. 2 of them will work with an X and 1 won't. And
I guess I'm talking about boarding hardware. Right.
I completely agree. Those document hardware and hardware changing in terms of the implementation without changing the model number is a major pain. And sadly, most of the vendors can get away with it because 90% of the market is Windows, where they just ship binary drivers with them. So the best way to get that sold is for all the free operating systems to decrease market share, we will say 10-15%, and there not be one single competing free operating system to which they again start supplying binary drivers. Diversity is good because it keeps vendors honest. And yes, we put pressure on vendors. Let's be fair. So we buy 15,000 desktops per year. Intel ships 50 million CPUs per year. And we don't have that much leverage.
Who cares about it? Linux can fight with OS X and Windows and the desktop. That's fine. Sorry, my own opinion. But, whatever happens to the desktop, happens to the desktop. But what about RAID cards?
I hear you, and
that's really where the focus is. Because Morgan Stanley might not buy as many as say, the NSA, but you could actually probably say that 0.011% of, your firm might be buying.
Yes and no, in terms of RAID cards, I see that example because we use stores and networks.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's.
I
agree. And
network hardware.
I don't think we focus on the discussions we have with vendors in terms of what we expect them to do. But let's be fair, every vendor that we deal with, we tell them, you only buy your hardware if it supports Linux, if the driver is open, we don't like binary drivers, we do want documentation, and we then sort of expect that if a GPO driver based on the documentation, open source is available for Linux, that previously people can work on that as well.
Yeah.
And then beyond that, frankly, also commercial company, they don't want to buy stuff that's cheap. So we don't want to pay $1 million extra just so that somebody in Canada or here can build a driver for it. And then that's sort of the caveat. I think it's time to do it.
Okay. No, let's ask 12 more questions.
And if anybody gets it,